Well, hey, friends. I'm Mark Grollo, back again. Welcome to WikiGod Podcast. Our stories, shaping God, in Toronto again this week, and this is episode 37. And we're Wikiing God again today with the sharp and humble and inspiring Aaron Oxford, pastor and director at the Dale Ministries in Parkdale. And so this is part two of that conversation. You probably caught part one. So that's coming up in just a few minutes. But before we get to Aaron, I want to explore with you this week just a little bit about money and the church. Oh. Now, just a second. Take a snapshot there of the emotion you felt just now when I said that, money and the church. Depending on your background, you'll have a number of different approaches and responses to that, reactions maybe. We'll come back to how you felt there, but just remember it. Remember how you felt, because it's precisely what I want to talk about. Not just the topic, but how you felt about it. Because when we say giving and the church, or more specifically, giving to the church, that's what we really hear when we hear giving and the church, right? I think there's essentially one of two responses, with slight varying degrees. I think a good analogy for our gut response might be the way people argue about paying taxes. It seems that, and I got in a conversation about this with my next door neighbor, who's from Iran, just moved here 5 years ago, and it's something that he's observed about North Americans. It seems that a Canadian approach, he says, and I agree, to paying taxes, a Canadian approach is kind of where we say, well, I'm donating some of my money to the community. I'm donating it to the common good for goods and services and things we all need. And I'm happy. I'm pretty happy to contribute along with everyone else towards all those things into the pot. A more American approach, again, this is from what we observe to the north, if you're listening to this down south. Stereotypes are never good, so you know, take it with what I'm saying here. But especially around election time, we kind of observe this rhetoric that paying taxes means I'm giving up what's mine. You know, I'm entitled to this money. The government is taking it from me. And so I think giving to the church can be quite similar in terms of responses. Churchgoers can look at it as contributing together for goods and services and resources and things that we all need together. Or they can look at it as the church is chiseling away at my money, what I'm entitled to, what is mine. And I think the level on which churches have engaged the topic of giving over the last few decades is that. There's option A. You can see your giving as a discipline, as contributing to the work of the church community as a whole. Or option B, you can be selfish with your money, choose not to give, and frankly, you need a heart check. So a lot of sermons and discipleship classes and whatnot would try to address that heart check if you're not giving, and maybe rectify people's hard hearts in terms of giving to the work of the church, the programs, the staff salaries, the building costs to keep the lights on, the growth fund, whatever you want to call it. Give to the church. If not, hard-hearted, not pulling your weight, that kind of thing. Well, I've been thinking about it, and I feel like there has been, in this generation, Gen Y and millennials, I think there's been a sea change in how much of our income we are willing to hand over wholesale to the church we attend. I mean, churches talk about tithing. We trot out some Old Testament verses about paying kind of temple taxes and civic fees for the 10% thing. But studies continue to show that people who don't identify with a church give an average of 2 to 3% of their income to charity and nonprofits. And interestingly, people who do identify with a church give an average of 2 to 3%, you guessed it, of our income to the church. So it's the same. And add to that, churches continue to see either a plateau or a decline in their giving year over year, even as attendance might be increasing. So more people are coming, but less in giving. This indicates that it looks like people are actually giving less and less. So, you know, with Christians if Christians suddenly started doubling what they're currently giving to the church, that means they'd be at like 5% of their salary, maybe 6. So if Jimbo is making 70 grand a year, he is in reality, by the average we're seeing, kind of kicking in about $1,400 to his church or his favorite nonprofit. Or, you know, if he's into both, he'll split the $1,400 between the two, maybe. And churches just cannot count on the revenue going forward that they've grown accustomed to from the baby boomer generation. And I'm sure that it's not a case of it being stingier. I don't think that's the case, although this generation is definitely saddled with more debt coming out of school or unable to find meaningful jobs the way our parents did and suffocating from unaffordable housing. But I actually think it's a case of us. We give differently in my generation and below me. We give directly, I think, to one-off causes that really mean a lot to us. Or we give to nonprofits that we know are extremely efficient in what they do, streamlined, and they're addressing a major social issue like child poverty or human trafficking or something like that. We contribute towards wells or flocks of goats or microloans that we know are really going to have long-term tangible impacts on people's lives. And this leads to the second point about money in church. It seems to me that in the future, as revenues continue to decline for churches, churches need to stop feeling the need to provide the goods and the services and the resources that plenty of other institutions and organizations are already creating and providing far better than we ever could. They're begging for our money and our business. So like 150 years ago, the vicar or the pastor was often the most educated person in town. And so of course it would make sense that he teach us for 40 minutes every week, 45 minutes, an hour back in the day. People wanted to hear what this educated, the most educated person in town had to say. This is under a Protestant model, of course. 150 years ago, the church was the primary dispenser of social justice work, soup kitchens and shelters and even public schools and hospitals. 150 years ago, if you wanted a sublime musical worship experience, it was the church that provided it. You had to go there. You had to attend to take it in. I could go on with more examples, but do you see how all of this has changed now, 150 years later? As we look into the 21st century, not only are pastors often less educated than many or most of the people in the seats, we now have access to thousands of sermons and lectures and seminars online with just a click of a button. So what does that mean for the role of the pastor and what the pastor should or should not be talking about up there? Not only are congregations no longer the primary dispensers of social justice work, I mean, as a congregation, maybe Christians are, but as congregations, church incorporated, but nonprofit work has been institutionalized, and that means highly specialized individuals through organizations doing extremely streamlined and efficient work with established networks of contacts, et cetera, et cetera. And not only does Sunday congregational worship not even hold a candle to any of the recorded music we can get our hands on nowadays on the internet or you know, CDs or MP3s, but on any given weekend or month in the city, there's always some organization putting on an amazing worship concert or a band staging a terrific sensory worship experience with professionalism and extreme talent because it's all they do and they want us there. So I'm not advocating here. I'm not suggesting bringing all these things to an end within our church groups, but I'm just saying maybe it's time to reconsider shelling out so much money for them, kind of dropping the money in the plate to pay for things that are being provided elsewhere more excellently. I think the analogy of family works really well here to kind of expand what I'm saying. In my family, I'm not going to be the primary educator of my children's, the reading, writing, and arithmetic, not primarily. We have access to institutions that are all about delivering the best possible education experience to our kids. Now I'm going to send them to school, to college, to university if they like, and I'm going to supplement those institutions in the evening and on weekends and always be kind of in teaching mode, but there's a teacher and a class and a curriculum already there and available that I'm happy to send my kids to. Those things already exist. Another example using family. It's important. It's so important to sit around together and sing around the campfire or driving in the car or whatever at dinner time. But I'm not going to suggest that, we be the best family at it and we invest hundreds of dollars in it, sounding fantastic when we get together and sing. We got to sound perfect. We got to sound. What if somebody hears us? What if guests come over and they hear us? They've got to be impressed. No way, right? Because just doing it together as a family, regardless of how it sounds, is the point. It's not how it sounds. It's not about blowing each other away. And so another example, when my children start to know this thing about the world that needs fixing, some issue, whether it's environmental or social, when they notice that and want to do something about it, Daddy, Mommy, what's going on there? Why are people chopping down so many trees? Or why do some kids go hungry? I'm not gonna kind of try to figure out personally a way that the four of us can get over to India and give money to a child or tackle child poverty, just the four of us reinvent the wheel. No, we're going to start exploring nonprofit organizations in the area that we can partner with in the neighborhood, maybe to accomplish the change that my kids are becoming sensitive to and want to work with and work on. See what I'm saying? This is an analogy. I'm not saying it goes away. We do it, but the way we do it is different. The church is at a point, I think, where we need to see ourselves in the same way as family. This crossroads is a huge opportunity to rethink what we're paying for and why. Church people need theological education and training on how to read and handle the Bible, I think. Just anybody who follows Jesus needs that. Good. There are many institutions providing that service. I think the pastor gets up and he or she talks about the gospel, reminds us that we're God's beloved no matter what we did. And that's essentially all that really needs to be communicated in a liturgical setting. If you want to get down to nitty-gritty textual analysis and all that super important stuff, genres of scripture, there are so many institutions out there that can do that and are doing that and desperately want you to attend and maybe even need you to attend to continue to survive. Church people need to get together and sing and definitely bond over that experience. Excellent. But we also maybe need a transcendent, goosebumpy professional experience from time to time too. And there are excellent organizations and amazing bands doing that all the time. And so church people maybe need to pitch in and help out and go to those things. What about the social justice thing or the charity thing or however you want to say it? Well, church people need to pitch in and help Ken and Sue, for example, for a couple of weeks of dinners and a mortgage payment because Ken just lost his job. This is a fictional couple, but you know what I'm saying. Excellent. We need to do that. But we also need to help with, the earthquake relief efforts in Nepal. Terrific. So there's legions of efficient and specialized organizations that are going to make that happen. And maybe, just maybe, the church, this church, our church, with a little reimagining, can afford to start spending way less money on our own staff and our own building and our own ministering to ourselves. So there's that piece. And third and finally, I wonder if completely rethinking our approach to giving and our ask about money to people sitting in the room, I wonder if this can actually rehabilitate the church's credibility in society. As we move kind of more fully into post-Christendom, one of the primary accusations leveled at church by non-Christians is, hypocrisy is probably number one, which I totally disagree with. That's probably another post, because the church should be full of broken people, and if you're going to accuse us of being hypocrites, that's good. We're broken and we're trying. So that's it. Okay. I don't want to fall down that wormhole. I think a major accusation leveled is they're just out to get my money. The church is just out to get my money. So whether or not that's true for an individual church or a specific church, it comes down to this. I mean, the prosperity preachers, the televangelists, the mega church pastors with the mansions and the planes, they're certainly not doing us any favors in that department in terms of turning people's opinions around about that. So what if we completely disarmed that objection? And what if we showed the world that that's not what we're about? And how do we do it? What if we agreed to a moratorium on asking for money? Complete moratorium. The church is not asking for money anymore. Now, of course, I realize this isn't a possibility for wonderful established churches with mortgages and buildings and the paid staff team and stuff like that. But church plants and new models just getting off the ground can certainly explore this option. And I think it would be just shock and awe to short-circuit that Generation Y cynicism around churches just being out to get my money. What if you came, started enjoying it, and we just refused your money? Like, we did not accept your money. What if we taught stewardship and ownership and investment and living simply and living generously and prioritizing that way? But we encouraged it to other organizations, other institutions, the homeless directly, the nonprofits in your neighborhood, and realize, as I said earlier, that we don't need to be raising money and reinventing the wheel and churning out, frankly, second-rate teaching every week when first-rate theological resources are all around us. We don't need to be providing second-rate music to kind of for other people's benefits when first-rate music, both live and recorded, is all around us. And we don't need to be reinventing second-rate kind of social action when there are first-rate organizations raising money and studying models and doing this work in a cutting-edge way just around the corner. I heard Bo Sanders over at the Homebrew Christianity podcast just last week say that when the church stumbles on something new, when there's a reformation and a renewal of some sort in the church, it's not like the old thing goes away completely. So when Protestantism came on the scene, the Catholic Church didn't just kind of wither up and, you know, roll up their shingle and die. And when Anabaptism came on the scene and started dunking people again, the sprinkling method didn't disappear. The child, the infant baptism didn't disappear. There's numerous other examples. So this isn't some sort of revolution manifesto here that I'm giving. I'm not saying that a group of people paying for specific people in their church to deliver goods and services and resources should cease and desist across the board, across the land for everybody. It'll never fully go away. But I have this crazy dream for the altar and churches like the altar and the next generation of churches. And it goes like this. We meet every week in my home and other homes when we outgrow my living room. We do some simple liturgy, creeds, maybe readings, creative meditational practices. And then we talk with each other in smaller triads about the past week's Bell's challenge. Who did we eat with? Who did we bless? What did we learn about Jesus when we read? What did our meditation yield to us? And did we write something down? How did we grow? And then we eat dinner together and maybe talk about the week's podcast guest, what was inspiring about them, so that it gets us thinking about work and churches outside of ourselves. And then we talk about how we might financially contribute to other places. And then maybe we talk about the churches that we're going to on Sunday morning. How was it? The weekly gathering is virtually cost-free with this model. And as for me, I'm you know, bivocational. I'm raising my own support, maybe, like all the other amazing people that I admire so much who raise their own support in order to minister where they're at. And it's not easy. If you told me 5 years ago that, you know, pastoring would mean being bivocational, I think I would have been depressed. I would have quit. I wanted that sweet paid staff church position. That was the goal. And now I can't even believe when I hear myself that I'm kind of passing that cup on. But now I really think I'm more and more convinced that the church of the future is going to have to follow the model of my friends in nonprofit ministry, people like Aaron at the Dale they're not trying to extract money from the very people they're serving. And so I'm cost-free to the community at the altar. And then when it comes to those other things, deeper theological training for us, we voluntarily pay for it. We either invite a professor to come and give us a seminar, or we individually sign up for seminary classes somewhere. When it comes to worship nights, if that's something we think we need, we look for a concert or a worship night to pay for and attend together and support that way. And when it comes to being charitable, social justice stuff, we look for organizations in West Lansing or in your neighborhood when you're coming out, and we talk about how we're giving, how much we're giving even. I think we're more frank talking about that if we don't think there's an angle or an ulterior motive. I think we can be pretty frank, and we can explore how we might do kingdom work in works already happening and being done by our Muslim and Buddhist and agnostic neighbors. And as we said last week, if you come to the altar and you attend a local church, you can keep giving to them even. The altar is not going to make you feel like you need to come around and give to us. I think money is a huge source of turfism between churches. Are you giving to them or are you giving to us? Who are you on board with? Well, when our model doesn't need your money, but rather we say the needy need your money. So who are you giving it to? Who are the needy? And maybe I want to give my money there too. Then we can work way more harmoniously as individuals, as church groups. And I think this model overall can give us more freedom, more credibility. We're not in it for the money. And we're not in it to expand our empire, make our building bigger, and make our package shinier. If the purpose of this whole church thing, and this struck me a few years ago, if the purpose of all this stuff that we do as church is just to become better followers of Jesus, I really think that's what Jesus would say. He'd look at us and say, is everything you're doing just about being able to look more like me, like a disciple of me? Well, then I think we can strip away everything that doesn't help us do that, and we can make sure the church is about discipleship and community. And then we can make sure the academy and educational institutions are about training and teaching. And then we can make sure that the paid artists are about worship experiences. And we can make sure that the nonprofits are about masterfully continuing to deliver social justice as they do so well. We make disciples as a church for almost no cost. And we mobilize the specialists in our community with our money for the rest of the week. All right, so remember when I started this whole talk with the word giving just at the top there? I said giving, and how did you feel then? Do you remember? And how do you feel now? Does something feel alleviated? Maybe? I hope. Can this work? I'd love to know if this can work. Let me know. Jump on the speak pipe. Leave me an MP3. Head over to the website. I'll give you more details about that. But your feedback as I kind of brainstorm about this is not the last word. It's a huge topic. But I just, I feel good about this. I feel like there's something here, but I'd love your input. More ideas is better. All right. Erin Oxford, she is such an inspiration. She serves our neighbors who are poor and marginalized and mentally ill in Toronto and Parkdale specifically. And the Dale is such a huge-hearted community of people. So here we go. We jump right back into the conversation for part two here as Erin is describing I don't want you to feel the loss. So Erin's describing as we hop back in what the weekly Sunday gatherings at the Dale look like. So then we go from there. So here's another week of Erin Oxford. Enjoy.
We stress that we want it to be a space where people can truly come as they are. Now, that's messy. And I'm not sitting here claiming that it's easy. But so we do have people arrive who are sometimes in a really desperate place when they come, who might be under the influence of a substance. Mm-hmm. And so we always say to people what we need to do, both at our worship service and at every other time during the week, is that it needs to be a safe and respectful place. And so if that's called into question somehow, if somebody is not making somebody feel safe or respected, we would have to challenge that behavior.
Okay.
our hope on a Sunday is that if somebody's in that space, we might be able to create another area for them maybe to sit and be. Mm. We always start our time with a bit of silence, intentional silence, because I think for all of us, our weeks can be so full of so many things.
Noise, just noise.
And so much
podcasts,
noise.
And things like that in our heads.
Yeah. And it's not, we don't always accomplish a completely silent space, but I always say, like, let's endeavor to quiet our hearts, even if there's other stuff going on around still. We sing, we have songbooks where people can call out and request a song. We use a stole, both as almost as a talking stick, so that when that stole is around somebody's shoulders, we know that we are to give them our full attention. But it's also been important for us to signify that we have a shared responsibility in the community, and that leadership isn't just for me to take. So I always invite somebody to place the stole on my shoulders.
What's happening there? Because you're just describing multi-participation.
Yes.
How are people doing that? What's the format there? Again, even in some of our traditional churches, two people do all the talking in a whole hour.
I know.
But you're describing a stole. You're describing wanting other voices. Specifically saying what or doing what?
Some people are... I always ask other people to do the reading of scripture.
Okay.
We have a community prayer time where everybody is invited to participate. Mm. We make clear that if praying out loud is not something that you're comfortable with, that we want people to recognize that our unspoken prayers are heard as well.
Mm.
But there's a lot of voices
that
contribute to our prayer time. I do teach. It is very conversational. Mm. I invite people to ask questions. I invite people to engage with whatever we're working through, whatever text we're looking at. We celebrate communion every week.
Mm-hmm.
And we serve one another the bread and the wine and the juice.
Yeah.
And quite often it's not me at the end who's sort of sending us on our way. So I invite other people to do almost a doxology and to release us and invite us into a week of peace. We also pass the peace to one another, which is an interesting exercise for us. I always need to make clear that that when we pass the peace to one another, that we need to do it in a way that's respectful to about whatever relationship we might be with that person. Mm. So we're trying to teach people good boundaries sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it could mean that we hug one another. It could mean that we wave at one another. It could, but let's share this peace with each other.
Mm.
And we do have an offering time where I always, and this usually is my voice, but inviting people to give back a portion of whatever it is that God has given them.
Mm.
And I really want people to hear clearly that that can look different than something that fits into an offering plate.
Mm.
That there are other ways to give. And that's part of the full participation that we're calling people into. And so to go back to the earlier part of the question about what's challenging about describing us as a church is that so often people think that a church is made self-sufficient through the tithes of its people. And so our struggle has been that the church world expects that of us. And then the sort of funding world also expects that of us because that's how churches work.
Yeah.
And so I'm always trying to figure out ways to describe us differently. We don't fit into the traditional box that I referred to in that quote.
Right.
And our people, our community, are giving and giving generously out of their very little.
Mm.
And I always say it's kind of like the widow's mite. I mean, it's, you know, we can take up an offering and it can be $9.01.
Yep.
But that,
although that's with the penny, it's more like 5 cents now.
Yeah, round up.
With the loss of the penny.
We need to round it up.
Is that going better for you guys or worse?
Oh, I don't know. So that's kind of what our Sunday thing looks like. And I want to acknowledge that I view everything that we do throughout the week also as an act of worship.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the giving of a cup of water, the feeding each other.
And that's why even for me to ask you, what that worship time, and then quickly I have to circle back and... Because I'm also trying to get away from that language of, oh, so Sunday worship. Well, Sunday, a kind of worship. It doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well.
I know.
Sunday, 10 o'clock, a kind of worship time. But because the rest of what you do is completely worship as well. The prayer walks and the visits and all that kind of thing. It's it's an expanded definition of worship. And yet, there's still something about that hour that people spend intentionally, like you said, reading or praying or singing or all the different expressions it can take. There is a vitality to it that kind of breathes life into a group of people.
Absolutely. And I think it fuels us for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
In a way, too.
Like communion every week. Why is that intentional for you?
The Dale community, and I include myself in that, is one that quite often struggles with the notion of grace.
Hmm.
And so it's become really important to consistently remind ourselves that we are invited to come, that we're not required to have it all together in order to come. In fact, it's when we discover that we don't, that we can fully embrace this notion of grace. So I feel like it's a very tangible way for us to be reminded of
that. You're taking anything about grace out of the world of ideas, and it's physically there in your hands.
That's right.
In communion.
And our community, again, like there are a number of people who take communion very seriously and sometimes struggle to take it because they feel like they're out of communion with somebody else or, you know, need to seek forgiveness and all of those things. And I think that too has been important for me to see coming from a more, affluent church background where we talked about taking that seriously, but it was very rare that somebody would take the time to go and say sorry to their brother or sister.
Right.
So we need the space in which to do that. And it's happening at the Dale. It's the moving of the Spirit, I'm convinced. There are people who whose buttons are pressed by somebody else and who get really angry and leave and maybe disappear for a little while, but those same people are now coming back and part of the prayer time will be, you know, to say, I'm sorry to this person directly. I realize that I need people to help set me straight, and then embracing during the peace.
Yeah.
Those really tangible things are happening.
It sounds like a lot happens in that hour and a half on Sunday.
It does.
It's not a formality, that's for sure.
No, it is not a formality, and I want people to know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, too, that the more that we do that and the more that we grow together as a community in that worship space, the more people are drawn into it. Mm. So, I mean, people find us, or sort of the entry point into the Dale community, is quite often via a drop-in.
Okay.
And for when we had a building, it always meant that somebody needed to actually find us. We were in a basement, so, and it wasn't the most accessible space. And so people needed to find us. I find now, by being out and about and in all of those pinned locations, yeah. that there's so much more opportunity for people to find us.
Okay.
And then once people, not that everybody stays, but once people kind of sense that there's this place where they can come and it's safe and respectful, that eventually they do end up. And it's not, we don't do those things so that they get to Sunday.
Right, right.
But I do recognize that that flow happens.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the challenge of is not overemphasizing one over another. For some reason, I feel like it happens naturally. Like a church group will start to say, let's pour resources into Sunday for whatever reason. Or another church will say, well, let's start pouring all of our resources into getting out there and being... the balance is hard.
The balance
Maybe
is very
the Dale
hard.
Is, the Dale is pulling it off.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, I feel like we're endeavoring to live in sort of the tension of that, right? Like yeah. that to be a church is not, in my opinion, either or, that it's both.
Yeah.
And that somehow we need to find, we need to live in the tension.
Yeah. You're kind of talking about the eclectic group of people that make up the Dale. Just want to ask you about a quote that you said. My desire for the Dale is that it will always place at its core people who know poverty, for it's through them that Jesus invites us to recognize our own. So in what ways would you say are our wealthiest Torontonians poor? In what ways are we poor, those of us who are pretty affluent and comfortable? And then what happens when we recognize our own poverty? Why is that important? Why is that something that you believe is helpful, beneficial, necessary?
Well, I always go back to the Beatitudes. And I feel there is this invitation to see that we are blessed in our poverty. We are blessed when we mourn. We are blessed, you know, all of those things. Mm. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness.
Yeah.
I feel like when we are stripped down to those places that we can't help but turn to God because there's so little left of us, and we realize that we need God to be in those places. So while, yes, there are many people in Toronto that aren't financially poor, who have maybe more than they could even ever dream of. I think the human condition is that so many of us know what it is to be lonely. So many of us know what it is to struggle with arrogance, and then on the other side of that, to struggle with feeling worthless.
But our toys help us cover that, don't they? Or distance ourselves from it?
Yes.
The more that we can acquire and buy, and we become less in touch with what you just said, our brokenness or...
I think that's true, but I think it really is just disguised.
Yeah.
I don't think that they really do fill the hole. Mm. And we all, I mean, I've had to ask myself in my own life, you've mentioned therapy in my own life, like there was a period where I felt like I stood to lose a lot, including when the Dale, formerly Parkdale Neighborhood Church, almost closed. Mm-hmm. Suddenly I found myself thinking this place that is a huge part of my identity is potentially gone. My father died. My mother is in hospital. My husband has multiple sclerosis. Mm. There's all of the challenge of, you know, being a healthy married couple. Yeah. You know, all of these things. If I lose all of this in a moment, which is possible for any of us, what am I left with?
Right.
And it was in that pretty desperate place that I realized that I couldn't find my value or my worth in anybody or anything. And I think that the reality is all of us could find ourselves in that place. Mm. That those with the largest wealth are also could just be paychecks away from finding themselves in a place like some of my friends do under a bridge.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing about raising your own support as well, which you mentioned to me before we started recording, this very scary prospect. Mm-hmm. And when I think about that, on the cusp of that as a church planter or whatever, it's scary. But it's funny how we seem to think that, oh, because if I had a salaried job somewhere, that's very stable. That itself is an illusion as well. But we just buy into certain illusions. I mean, we saw what happened with Future Shop last week or Target the week before. Just this, oh, those were secure jobs or those were salary jobs. And all of a sudden, they're not.
They're gone.
Yeah. So I feel like we buy into a sense of security that doesn't really exist, but it makes us feel better somehow.
I think it does.
And then when you're confronted with all the losses that you just mentioned, we realize, oh, what kind of narrative have I kind of established for myself?
And as painful as being in that place is, I think there's also great freedom in it, right? Mm. Because suddenly you realize that it's not just about the title that you hold, or it's not that there's something inherently valuable about you just because you are this beloved, created child of God. Mm. I think that's... And for the Dale, like, we had that experience of having to give up so much. We gave away almost everything we owned. We gave notice in the building that had been our home for a long time. And I don't want to belittle how hard that was, because it was hard.
Yeah.
And there was loss, especially for a community that doesn't have much of its own to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, the freedom that was born out of that, of no longer needing to worry about a leaky roof or, having to pour a lot of money into maintenance and the keeping of stuff.
Yep.
Suddenly we didn't have that.
Yep.
And so we were freed to just simply walk the neighborhood.
Mm.
And I think... So was it loss? Yes, but was also all of this other stuff. And there's beauty in that. And so, I guess my hope is that for Torontonians who find themselves, with much.
Yeah.
I think there are lots of people who will live and die with much, but to hold it lightly, for all of us to learn how to share what we have is so important.
And not allow it to cover what you said, that realization that with it or without it, we're stripped down, we're children of God.
That's right.
It has nothing to do with what we have or don't have.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You talk about having to close the Dale almost. It's quite a paradox that when that happened, again, it seems to have, if you Google the Dale, all these stories come up about how the Dale almost closed. It seems like that's kind of what vaulted the Dale into the circles of awareness of everyone else. It's just so paradoxical that you've been doing all this good work and doesn't get a lot of play. When you almost close, everyone's talking about it. That's what it seemed. Maybe it didn't feel like that at the time, that everyone was talking about it. But I've read the story, and a lot of churches started pitching together and coming together. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you saw?
Well, I guess it was ironic for us that we were facing closure, but yet there was this huge community of people who were gathering still all the time. And so the closure was really, we had to face that we had some structural challenges and financial challenges.
But there was still a vital group of people.
There was this vital group of people. Not, yeah. That's right. And so that's why it felt so important to me that it continue.
Hmm.
I felt a really deep sense of call to stay, and was invited to try and reimagine what we could be. And I think I sometimes wonder if there was sort of a, you know, when things are sort of going, moving along, and we were busy doing our thing,
yep,
as Parkdale Neighborhood Church, that it's easy to fly under the radar.
Mm.
And
being comfortable does that to everybody, right?
That's right. Yeah. So suddenly we were made very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think we needed to learn too, that we needed to learn how to share our story more. And so I think it was in the telling of our story. I think it was in the sharing of these profound things that were happening in Parkdale that people started to take notice of what was going on and started to recognize that this thing did need a broader network of support.
Yeah.
That there was something important happening there. And it was important that it continue.
It kind of reads like a biography, of somebody where something tragic happened and then it turned around and that person, you know, is different and successful, whatever that means. I feel like that's what's compelling about the story of the Dale is, from your side, the daily work that you do, it's certainly not glamorous, but from the outside looking in, that sense that it was, you know, these are a group of people doing great things and then threatened financially and then finding kind of a revitalization in new partnerships and now moving forward and reinventing itself. And that's the way it looks. I think that's what's compelling about the story.
In the midst of our challenge, a friend of mine sent me this really beautiful Advent reading that included a quote from somebody about how the cradle of darkness is sometimes where things grow.
Hmm.
Or I think it was titled The Ancient Symmetry of Growth, that it seems strange or paradoxical that you'd have to commit a seed into the darkness of the earth in order for it to grow up. And I feel like that's been a really good metaphor for me in all of this, seeing how maybe we needed to go through some very dark things. In order to take on new forms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even leaving the basement, in a sense, like we'd sort of considered ourselves this underground thing. And suddenly we were forced up and out. Like it felt like this.
A loss of identity in a way.
Yeah. But also this opportunity for us to see who we were up on the ground level and closer to the street again. Yeah. Not that we weren't. I mean, so much of what Parkdale Neighborhood Church was, it was beautiful and it was built by a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it is a lot of our foundation.
Right? Like
that's right.
Yeah. That's one thing that I was surprised. It goes back.
It goes way back.
Yeah, decades.
Yeah. All of that work, you know, has helped inform who we are.
Yep.
It just was that it was this opportunity for us to maybe be able to more clearly articulate who we had become.
Yeah.
And to maybe struggle less in acknowledging that we were this thing that was hard to define and that we were going to be okay with that.
Yeah.
And to kind of push back on some of the definitions that people wanted to put on us.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to go through a blog post that you had of 10 lessons. You posted it very recently because you're coming up, or you probably just passed it, 3 years
in your role.
3 years. So you're this grizzled, wizened veteran of ministry.
Far from it.
Yeah, 3 years is still quite a baby. But your 10 lessons are amazing. Now we don't have enough time to go through, so I'm just kind of scanning them to see. We've covered almost everything, but one thing that I really want to focus on, because it dovetails nicely with what you're saying, and that sense of reinventing church, because this might be the future for many, many churches. Number three, the thing you learned is the Dale needs and thrives because of partnerships. The sense that, like you said, with $9 in the offering plate and with you raising your own support and this kind of ministry that does this kind of impact and fostering this kind of community needs and thrives because of partnerships. Can you kind of sketch out maybe what kind of partnerships, first of all, but then how it's crucial to who you are? It might not be as comfy, cozy as a community, like you said, that brings in all the cash it needs in the plate on Sunday, but it is also the basis that causes you to get out and things like that. So what kind of partnerships? Obviously, all these... See, I'm bringing back the bulletin board that I pinned.
Yes.
All these buildings and spaces, those are partnerships, you would say?
Yeah, I would definitely describe them as partnerships. We still are a church now without our own walls.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we rely on the walls of others and feel fortunate that there have been enough places that have been willing to allow us in.
Mm.
So we couldn't do what... I mean, we couldn't do what we do.
Did that seem crazy to you at first?
Oh.
Like having to reimagine... Because I don't know any churches that bounce here, there, here, there, here, there. For you, for the Dale, it feels so right. It's like, that's who you are. But 3 years ago, did it seem... Is that even possible?
Terrified. I was terrified. I felt completely ill-equipped. I still do.
Okay.
In many ways. And there were times when I said to myself, this is crazy. What are you doing? You're crazy. What, like, there? How can this work? How can this possibly work?
Mm.
And somehow I felt like the next steps that we needed to take were, I knew what the next steps were because they somehow, the light was provided by God to take that next step. So I knew, like, for the first 6 months, it was primarily me knocking on doors and saying to people, this is who we are. This is what we do. Can we talk? Like, you have this great building and I know that, you know, that there's space available or that there's nothing going on at the very least during these times. Would you be willing to share it with us? How can we work together? What does it look like to not reinvent the wheel? You want to be involved in doing a drop-in. Maybe rather than starting another one, come and be a part of this one, and we can do it together. So the partnership isn't just about the space, though it's largely about that. It's also an opportunity to invite people into the work that we're doing.
Yeah, because a partnership implies that mutuality.
That's right.
So... The Dale is bringing something more than some rental cash or whatever. It's kind of an infusion of...
Definitely. Well, and especially when the Dale is hardly paying any cash for any of the spaces. Yeah. Like, it's not...
You have to approach people differently.
That's right.
We'll line your pocketbooks if you give us a few hours.
Yeah, that's not the case.
Yeah.
We also... I would say that partnership for us also is this... sort of wide range of individuals who have chosen to support my salary specifically, but more generally, the Dale and my coworker Joanna is doing the same. And so she brings with her a new network of supporters.
Yep. Would Second Harvest, would you consider that
a
partnership?
Definitely.
They make the drop-in possible.
Yeah, we wouldn't. There were times, honestly, when I didn't know if there would be enough money to pay for the groceries that we needed. And Second Harvest was the reason why our drop-in never had to cease. And, I mean, I don't say this lightly. I feel like I was witness to like loaves and fishes being replicated.
Yeah, you mentioned that. Like things went way farther than
they
should
have. Yeah. They still do. There are times when we look around the room and we think, oh, this is a busy day. And did we, like, it felt like we didn't get as much food as we normally do. How's this going to be? And then we're still sending people home with yogurt containers of leftovers.
It's amazing.
It's truly amazing. Mm. So, yeah, Second Harvest, a host of churches, the denomination that we're still affiliated with, all of these people came around.
Yeah.
And they're partners.
Yeah. It's a beautiful and compelling story.
Thank you.
Maybe just one more question while I still have you here. And it's kind of a callback question I ask every guest. What would you say is the good news that the Dale is bringing to Parkdale, bringing to Toronto? What would be that kind of nutshell good news that the Dale is bringing?
I want the good news of the Dale to be the same good news that we read about in the New Testament. I want the good news for everybody who comes to be that they are loved, that it is in the context of what we're doing at the Dale that we want to provide a space for them to, for all of us to sort of rediscover who we are, to learn how to disagree well, to to trust that we're not going to shun anybody because of something that they may have done wrong. I want the good news to be that there's hope, that we can hope in a life that goes far beyond the one that we know right now. I want the good news to be that we're willing to share what we have with one another so that more and more people will not go without.
Yeah.
I want the good news to be that the kingdom is in many ways already here.
Yeah.
And that we look forward to it being fully realized.
That's a great answer. I'll rubber stamp that.
Thanks,
thank you,
Mark.
So much.
It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks so much. Anything else you wanted to say? Disappointed that I didn't ask?
Oh, dear. No, I think this has been a really good conversation.
I
hope that I've answered.
Oh, you have.
Well.
And I think hope. We know more about the Dale and the partnerships. And so how does a listener interact with the Dale? Somebody listening to this in Toronto, that this is their first exposure. Well, what do you think someone could do with this now, knowing a bit more about you, knowing what the Dale is, where it is?
Well, the invitation is open to everybody to come and be with us. We would invite anybody to come and share a meal on a Monday or to come on a Sunday, to any of those things that I've mentioned.
And the website
is a good
place.
They're all listed on the website. Yep. We're pretty active on Facebook, and so if that's a platform that you use, you can go there. You can follow my blog. You can follow my coworker, Joanna Moon's blog.
Okay.
There's a lot of opportunity. You can read any of the articles that you've already mentioned and that we're so grateful for.
Yep.
Yeah, but I think just to know that the invitation is extended for people to come and learn more and that the expectation is very low. We just want people to know that we're here.
Well, creating a space where people can take off their masks, you say it's the low expectation, but that could be maybe the highest thing that we're calling people to do. It's the hardest thing, I think.
It is hard, and it's good.
Well,
so much of what's hard is
community.
Deeply good.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, there you go, Aaron Oxford. Aren't you sad to see her go? That was such a great conversation. She doesn't have to be gone, though. You can engage. You can engage the Dale. Drop in, as she said. The invitation is there. I've linked up the Dale's webpage. Also, you can read her very extensive and detailed blog. You can just be almost creepy about it. Just go way back years and years and read everything about her. It's a fantastic blog. You get a sense of her journey. I've also directly linked the 10 Things I Learned blog post that she put up. That we were talking about in the conversation, so you can check that out, all that in the show notes. Thanks a lot, Aaron. That was fantastic. As for us this week, the WikiGod community, well, I'd love to hear your feedback on everything I talked about. I'd love to hear your perspective. So what could you do this week? Well, the website is www.wikigodpod.com. You can leave a comment. Again, I love the SpeakPipe option. You can leave me an MP3. It's kind of a voicemail. And I'd love to hear kind of where you're at, how you felt when we talked about church and giving or giving to church, and where you're coming from. Are you a paid pastor? Are you a church staff person? Are you a person who doesn't go to church because you feel like we're just a bunch of money grubbers? So it'd be interesting to hear where you're coming from and what you think of a model that doesn't want your money, that talks about stewardship, talks about giving, living simply, giving generously, but doesn't want it. Hit me up on Facebook, WikiGod Podcast. Hit me up on Twitter, at WikiGod Pod. And love to hear from you. Direct messages, public tweets, whatever you want to do. And this week, just explore your feelings around church and giving and money. Be honest about it. Even think about your 2 to 3% or your 10% or your 15%, how much you're giving. Assess that and think, is this what I want to be doing? All right, next week, you don't want to miss it, our episode 38, Dr. Cyril Garrett. He's a pastor of Free Church Toronto. He's a professor at Heritage, and he's a rapper under the moniker Ill Seer. You do not want to miss that conversation. We geek out. We talk about God and church and faith and gospel and philosophy and all kinds of awesome stuff. So, see you next week. Thanks for joining us. Have a great one.